So welcome everyone. I'm honored and happy. Welcome on the podcast of Ewa Majewska, who is me, and the podcast is called From Weak Resistance to Weak Avant-Garde. And I have the honor and pleasure to have as guest Marc Leger, who is a Marxist cultural theorist living in Montreal. Through class analysis, critical cultural theory, and Lacanian psychoanalysis, his work examines the repressive sublimation of culture and politics in the context of the rise of the rise to hegemonic status of petty bourgeois ideology. And then the list of works that Marc Leger authored is super long, so I can't really go and read all of them. But Brave New Avant-Garde book from 2012, Don't Network the Avant-Garde After Networks from Minor Compositions, The Idea of the Avant-Garde and What It Means Today, Volume 1, Volume 2. So basically, all your books discuss, I think, capitalism as a system. However, a large part of those publications, also the publications that you edited, co-authored, focus on artistic production. And so I chose those publications as a introductory part of your bio. So welcome, Marc. I'm super happy to have you as a guest in this podcast. And I would like to start, like I start with most of my guests. What is avant-garde to you?
Well, thanks, first of all, Eva, for having me on your podcast. I'm very happy to just be discussing with someone the theory of the avant-garde, because, as we both know, there's a phenomenon in academia where the avant-garde has been consigned to history for many reasons. So just to answer your question very, very quickly, I don't have a recollection of the exact moment. Obviously, growing up, being interested in popular culture and being interested in the more artistic, experimental sectors of popular culture, you already have a sense of what you might think of as the 19th century avant-garde, this kind of alternative culture, this anti-bourgeois, anti-establishment sensibility that associates with underdogs and about people who are resisting something like, you know, the powers that be. So that, you know, has been with me for a long time. But after my BA, looking into urban theory, people like Frederick Jameson, David Harvey, the discussions around postmodernism, the postmodern city, and the feminist debates that are around that, those were all things that I was doing on my own before I decided to do an MA in art history. I was coming out of the history program. So those were very exciting. And I was just kind of getting a sense of the postmodern discussion with, like, finding at the bookstores semiotext books. And so reading people like John Tagg, who was writing about photography, police photography in a Foucauldian framework. So wanting to know, you know, what it was that Jameson and Harvey were opposing. So I was kind of interested in all facets of this development in terms of culture and theory. Mm-hmm. Then getting into more specific studies during my MA and PhD, then it became a matter of concretizing these interests. And this article, I think, might have been a factor in me editing two volumes of The Idea of the Avant-Garde, which is a forum of ideas by people working in all the different arts sectors, theater, literature, architecture, on what their thoughts are about the avant-garde today. And it's by, you may know this book, one of the Dia Art Foundation, Discussions in Contemporary Culture, with a piece by Christoph Fadichko. He wrote an essay called Strategies of Public Address. And in this, he outlines his sort of breakdown of historical neo with historic avant-gardes, socially engaged avant-garde from 20s to 30s, critical neo-avant-garde from 60s to 70s, situationist avant-garde as revolutionary force, 60s to 70s, and present critical public art, new avant-garde. Much of the latter would be sort of in the pictures generation idea, more a postmodern category for other thinkers, but in Badichko's terms, not using the October group definitions, having his own sort of set of categories with very, like, if you look at critical neo-avant-garde with Daniel Buren and Hans Hacke, for example, uses these kinds of sentences like critical dash affirmative action.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very deeply Hegelian. And I was reading the article that you actually sent me before we started this conversation, the article retroactivating the idea of the avant-garde, and I found it super useful indeed. So thank you very much for sharing that with me, because I was very focused on your books and some of this article escaped my attention, but it's actually also very good to as it combines your different interventions in discussions concerning avant-garde. And I noticed that you were discussing and using a lot of concepts from John Roberts, a super prominent British art theorist and historian. And I was wondering about Hegelianism, because somehow in Roberts, this Hegelianism is very highly intellectual. It's like sublation of, you know, art by intellect somehow. I'm very much damaging the richness of Robertson's thoughts by this formulation, that I think there is something very Kantian in Robertson's reading of Hegel and the avant-garde. And I don't know
if I would agree with you. I don't see Kantian, I see Adornian.
Okay, but yeah, but still like highly prioritizing the intellectual and rational over everything else. Well, for me, I grew up in a Hegelian philosophy cluster in Warsaw, where Hegel was presented on one hand as the true admirer of the public sphere in its heterogeneity. So this was one of my teachers, Marek Sienok, who taught me that. But more importantly for our conversation, another of my teachers would speak of the priority of the comic and comedy in Hegel's aesthetics. Somehow the comedy comes, you know, as the legacy.
The comedy.
And this is not the sublation of art by the reason as such. It's more sublation of art by the subconscious, by the paradox, by the contingent. So it's a whole different understanding of how aesthetics, you know, ends in Hegel. And I think it's perhaps a little bit more towards your alley. But for Hegel, the history is embodied. So therefore, it's actual people in actual bodies and actual cultures speaking actual languages and living in specific climate for us that are also specific economy.
It isn't matterism. It's not this sort of materialist, this kind of like, you know, when you bring that conversation, the Hegelian conversation, into the Marxist mm-hmm. discussion, which is the way I approach it as a Hegelian Marxist, you know, what Hegel brings about is this kind of like almost historicized idea of what you might call something like the body, which might for us today be something like a Balibarian strategies kind of logic. And this is exactly for me, the problem. It's this technocratic approach to politics.
We need to distinguish, however, Hegel's explicit statements about the body, which are, as you just said, unacceptable today after also feminist reconstruction of the body as cultural and gendered phenomenon. After all we know, obviously, this is not inspiring. What I find inspiring as the kind of secondary body theory in Hegel, let's say, instead of seeing that kind of figure in the next chapter of Phenomenology of Spirit, I discover there a tired housewife. And what I do with this chapter is precisely, it's very similar to what Susan McMorris does with the chapter on slavery and on slave and master, which is basically a very close reading of the text and finding that the words that are being used there, they are depicting the boredom, the repetitiveness, the mundaneness of the world that sustains life. Yeah, but interestingly, I find it in Hegel. So I'm thinking Hegel had this ability of you know, doing the mimesis from kind of real surrounding life into his philosophy of the voices that he was hearing. And I think the voices of servants were very much something that he would somehow capture while living in Germany of early 19th century. And so therefore, I'm thinking of this ability of including in a highly abstract philosophical project the elements of the everyday. And this is how so it's a close reading of Hegel's text. This is a close examination of the actual vocabulary that he's using. So my interpretation is going away from this more symbolic one, you know, from Judith Butler's, for instance, who would see Hegel as somebody who hates the body. I'm not sure, because he's defending this kind of perspective about the body, its functions and its preservation in this specific chapter when he depicts all the effort that is necessary to sustain it. So somehow it's a more radical reading of Hegel, you would say, or it's a more heterodox?
I don't know if it answers your question. Probably not, because it's not, you know, based on the readings that you're doing. One is, I appreciate how your podcast was designed to serve your thesis. You're a host who is Hegelian in this subjective way, right? So this is important. Another thing, instead of this kind of like liberal sort of, you know, kind of interests, you know, the play of interests sort of thing. Also, in terms of Judith Butler, I don't know if this is important to you, but the book Contingency, Hegemony, Universality, I think for me is kind of definitional of where the distinctions lie between a Judith Butler approach, radical democracy, which I used to be interested in when I was a reader of Rosalind Deutsch, but I've, you know, moved away from that, and Zizek's position, to which I'm much closer. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, this is maybe like really like unimportant, but why not an example? Because I have a preference for Martha Rosler to Abramovic.
Mm-hmm. Me too. It seems clear, I think, from the podcast, obviously.
Yeah, but I appreciate that you want to, like, the contrast is interesting, and I appreciate that I'm sure you're going to give Abramovic the best reading possible.
But anyhow, what I'm thinking about your work on the avant-garde is that, correct me if I'm wrong, this, it's not that I'm an expert on your work, but it proceeds quite in a quite linear fashion. Would you agree that you situate actually quite precisely one period of avant-garde after another, or would you see a kind of heterogeneity of strands within avant-garde that, you know, progress parallel in relations with each other? How would you, you know, help me understanding the timeline?
Yeah, there's definitely a timeline. So you can call it something, you could fit it within something like the concept of modernity rather than post-modernity. All of these artists like Vito Acconci, who are doing these strange performance things, become art, become celebrated by the museum. Why? Because the museum doesn't care, right? It has no criteria. It's more interested in, you know, allowing artists to express themselves and by that displaying their liberal democratic.
Can I interrupt you here? Because I'm thinking of all those minoritarian groups that when they enter into art museums, first of all, they contradict the tremendous efforts to keep them at bay from visual arts, from art scene more broadly, but also if we look at, I don't know, Roma artists in Poland, for instance, these people were relegated to ethnographic museums for decades. Regardless, even if they had full artistic education, were highly professional artists in contemporary art disciplines, they would still be pushed towards. So then now when they appear in the museums, I'm not sure if this process of commodification of their work and their labor, basically, is so complete, is so full, as it is in the case of the artists that belong to majoritarian groups. So here is a tiny window, in my view, for some kind of resistance to the commodification processes on one hand, but also a kind of another reality, a non-liberal. So even if those people are liberal, the most famous Polish Roma artist is quite liberal, I would say, as a, you know, political being. And yet, the art she brings in, museums in Venice Biennale and other quite prestigious places that she exhibited, those places can't consume it so easily, I think. I mean, they can try. They make all the effort in the world to sort of, you know, nice maintenance of the status quo values. However, when we see a group of, you know, 30 Roma women embroidering, I think something changes in our perception of the museum, of contemporary art, of production, of everything, basically. And here I would locate, you know, the potential for kind of avant-garde, you know, value of her work as opposing the existing reality, as proposing some sort of alternative, as finding some informal solutions. So I wonder what you would think of this kind of, you know, this kind of interpretation of access into the contemporary art of minoritarian groups. Does it make such a difference for you, or would you say it works in the same way exactly?
Well, I've been answering that question for the last four books that I've written. So the framework for me is the class analysis. To what extent is the Marxist class analysis part of that discussion? In other words, to talk about capitalism does not necessarily imply a Marxist perspective or critique of capitalism. So is that, one way to answer it would be, John Roberts talks about the metastasis of art and politics. Mm-hmm. So you always have labor on the one hand, political economy, I like this formulation by the editor of Minor Compositions, Stephen. That you have two superstructures, politics and art, politics and culture and labor. So you have a kind of like grounding in political economy. So this kind of triangulation. John is talking more about art and politics, so culture and politics. And that's fine, like that you is doing something very similar in the sense that he's trying to occlude the question of political economy, because he doesn't want to make Marxist definitions of politics the only definition of communism. So John talks about the metastasis of art and politics. So basically in any avant-garde project, and I agree with you on this point in relation to your interest in Knecht and Kluge, proletarian public sphere. Mm-hmm. And also I exclude from avant-garde right-wing and fascist directions mm-hmm. for culture. At the level of politics, they fail entirely. So I make that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And I also distinguish the adjective avant-garde from the noun, the avant-garde.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I don't understand, you know, experimentation or novelty mm-hmm. as a, somehow, you know, the idea. Yeah, so Badiou, his idea of art is not in relation to politics per se, but philosophy. And so for him, philosophy, like just basic definition is truth. So what is the relationship of art to truth? And does art by itself in this romantic sense give the definition of truth? This you might find in Abramovich, for example.
Yes.
You know, herself.
Yes. Authenticity. Yeah.
And so the avant-garde was opposed to this because it located truth in metapolitics, basically, you know, the Marxist apparatus.
Mm.
And he's looking for an alternative to this 20th century avant-garde definition that he finds in Event. But it's a little bit problematic in the sense that in terms of this metastasis of art and politics, he's willing to question, he rejects it at the level of art, but he doesn't reject it at the level of politics.
Mm.
So a communist politics is fine, but the communist art is not fine.
And my question concerning Badiou specifically is whether his concept of art and this concept of inesthetic and this accentuation of truth, whether it does not fit in a support of, again, the hegemonic class within artistic production. So whether it does not align in the end with this very bourgeois thinking of neo-avant-garde, let me explain. In Andrzej Turowski, a Polish very prominent critic and theorist of avant-garde, he speaks of avant-garde, of post-war avant-garde especially, particularly as one moving within the bourgeois modes of expression. So he calls everything that sort of jumps out of this grid of the bourgeois habitus as non-avant-garde already. So my curiosity is, what would you think about, because this is like a very nice self-declaration of privilege, yeah? It's like, you know, an art critic saying we are only working within the bourgeois field. So how is Bourdieu different from that? How is Badiou different from that? How this concept of truth as content, main content of art, differs from this bourgeois mode of production kind of?
It does seem to revise something like a Habermasian distinction and a kind of very, emphasis, idea of aesthetics as formalist in some ways. And which is why I don't agree with it entirely, though, I mean, Badiou's a complicated thinker, so I don't want to reduce him to a soundbite. But I don't agree with your reference to neo-avant-garde being bourgeois art. This is something mm-hmm. I don't agree with from a historical perspective.
Okay. Can you elaborate on that?
I'm finishing a book on cinema, and my next book after that will be a history of the petty bourgeoisie, something along these lines, or a theory of the petty bourgeoisie. So that's very prominent in my work right now. You know, there was a lot of discussion on the social democratic left of the PMC in the last few years, and that interests me very much. And it's been the basis of the work that I'm doing, coming out of cultural studies and visual studies, and the fact that it tends to leave out anything having to do with Marxism, class analysis, and understanding of capitalism. Or if it accepts it, it accepts it as an earlier phase leading to these later, more seemingly sophisticated phases. And so, you know, I find in my work, I'm sometimes noticing that post-structural social constructionism ends up being very similar to Stalinism. in a lot of ways.
Let me give you one example. Yeah.
The focus on power on the one hand.
Yes. I must agree with you. I look at it from a perspective of somebody who just investigated police archives of a police of operation targeting gay men in the 80s in Poland. I went through a huge study of these archives, and what I discovered on the side of queer theory is resistance to anyhow address the state in a serious way. So if any time anybody claiming to be queer theorists try to discuss the state at the same time, they are seen as unorthodox, this would be the polite version, or exceeding the boundaries of queer theory. And I find this very negligent to the interests of the LGBTQ+ community, whose interest is supposed to be somehow represented by queer theory, I think. I assume that queer theory as one built within the experiences of first gay men, then, you know, gay people, trans persons, etc., etc., and then the queer experiences more broadly, should have this representational politics focused somehow on the interests. And then aesthetics brings a dimension in which perhaps some more experimentation is possible. So we can not maybe forget about the LGBTQA+ interests, but we can experiment with antisocial kind of, you know, this melancholic, nihilistic drive of rejecting the society as such. But this can be just a small part, I think, of the broad queer theory. And, you know, the rest of queer theory, especially in legal studies, social sciences, and places like that.
I would say, for what you just said, I would say that, and to me, Peter Berger answers most of that when it comes to 19th century anti-bourgeois bohemian avant-gardism. Like, much of this is very similar to the kind of 19th century bohemianism. You can refer to it as counterculture.
But also state phobia, I think, which, by the way, is the concept of Michel Foucault. Yeah, but also state phobia is something that consists in refusing of engaging with the state and also refusing to acknowledge the necessity of investing in institutionalization. I think that avant-garde historically was very preoccupied with creating its own museums. I think the most important early 20th century avant-garde projects were preoccupied with building a state which would, you know, form structures in which the art could, you know, do this important work of sublating the artistic in the social, no?
Sublation of this art into life theory. I mean, this is very key to the idea of why they failed, right? Because if they failed, we want to know where they failed and why they failed. And so part of that has to do with, what does the sublation of art into life imply? Does it imply the elimination of art? Does it, and so that when Peter Berger talks about failure, he says it failed in two ways. One, their practices were turned into received as museological forms of art, which the neo-avant-gardes don't really protest, right? They're kind of like beyond that in some ways, or oblivious to it. And the other is the aestheticization of everyday life.
Mm.
The aestheticization of everyday life is this kind of Foucauldian, you know, kind of life politics that is not really part of the definition of the avant-garde as far as Peter Berger is concerned. I was mentioning Heimendinger. One of the things he's doing is playing Blum's Jung, his definition of the development of field of autonomy as socially defined, against Peter Berger's. So he's kind of like constantly sort of saying, oh, well, this isn't that. And so therefore both of them. And I've done the opposite. I've tried to create a model that brings the two together.
Mm.
So for Berger, in a way, the avant-garde is the end point. So it's going to fail because it hasn't achieved its goals. And so we don't really know what comes after. He leaves open the possibility that we would have something like what the historical avant-garde conceived in the future, but he just doesn't see it now, sort of like that used intervallic communism moment that we're in right now. So for Berger, that's kind of like a telos, but it's wrapped up with, you know, the bourgeois disinterested idea, right? So it's kind of like it's sublated in this Marxist sense, the way Marxism retains something about enlightenment and idealism, which is what postmodernists and post-structuralists try to like squeeze their way out of as much as they can, right? And so dismiss the two at the same time, which is why they have nothing just good about to say about the bourgeois revolutions, mm-hmm. which for me are essential. So what I see happening in the post-war period is basically, and this is going beyond Berger, it's basically we're in a different phase. We're in this phase that's described better by Barbara Ehrenreich in her book, Fear of Falling. with the rise of this idea of the middle class, the American middle class, the consumer era middle class being the definition of culture. Mm-hmm. It's not interested in European high art, and it's not interested in the class and social debates that were part of those formations. It's this very kind of almost, you know, the phoenix that rises out of the ashes. It's like a new thing entirely. So that for me implies the kind of hegemony of the petty bourgeois habitus, which brings with it certain forms of production, consumption, and reception. This for me answers a lot of problems and difficulties between this kind of practice and that kind of practice. I haven't solved all the problems, but what I've done in addition to that, and Andrea Fraser has her own version of it, you've seen it, is relate that to Lacan's four discourses for within this historical, like, let's say, period that we're in. And if you have a petty bourgeois habitus that's dominant, maybe not on an economic level in terms of, like, you know, the billionaire class, but in terms of the cultural level, it changes how we think about, you know, what's happening in culture and what we expect from culture. And so then you get this kind of fragmentation in terms of the four discourses, of some of them having historical valences. But if you think of, like, say, Martha Rosler, you can fit her into different categories. She would fit best in discourse of the analyst, as well as discourse of the university. Abramovic would fit better in discourse of the master.
Yes and no, because I was thinking about it actually when you were speaking. I would experiment with positioning Martha Rosler also on the side of the hysteric. Why? Because I think some parts of her, of what I would call her success in failing, consists in choices that she didn't really consciously make. So, for instance, when she enters MoMA New York, the Kremlin of contemporary art, as she herself called it, back in the 70s, I think, she
has... What would it be now? What would the Kremlin be today?
No idea, actually. That's a very good question. I have no idea. I wouldn't say Brussels, not at all. I would still say Washington. Probably. But I don't know. I'm not sure. It's a different power structure that we live in right now. So I think, you know, historically we have moved from this point where, you know, there was a Kremlin and some other.
Donald Trump's state fair that he's planning for the 1776.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because all the artists he invited to this summer fair to celebrate the 250th anniversary.
All the artists have canceled.
Oh.
Except one guy called Vanilla Ice.
Let's not talk about him. It's enough of, like, white men, you know.
It's interesting.
I think Martha Rosler manages to fail in ways that she doesn't foresee while planning her exhibition. So I believe that, for instance, when she was planning the Meta garage sale at MoMA New York, she wanted to somehow ridiculize and criticize the art market as a zone of value production. So she wanted to contest the severe seriousness of the MoMA New York's value production in art sector by introducing the garage sale. But I think her sincerity in this act surpasses her plans. Somehow she is doing a very activist experiment. And while from the loudspeakers, everybody could hear a Marxist critique of the market and things like that, I don't think anybody was focused on that. I think everybody was really focused on the, you know, merchandise and making those little exchanges, et cetera, et cetera.
I'll say why I don't think she's hysteric. Somebody distinguished between, I don't know if this is something I would stick with, but Manet's challenge to the art field was one that basically you can consider it a failure. You know, the Déjeuner sur l'Ep was a failure, but it's a failure that was intended to succeed. Mm-hmm. In other words, he wanted his challenge to be accepted.
Yeah.
Whereas Duchamp with his fountain, he wanted his challenge to be refused. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't trying to, you know, to be accepted. So I'd say I would situate Martha Rosler with the discourse of the university more, because I think that she does want her failures to be accepted.
Thank you so very much for this encounter and this discussion.
Thank you, Eva. It was my pleasure.